Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How are you?
It's warm here again. We had a nice few respite for the last few days, but it's started getting toasty again.
Still foggy here. That's my report to you. I'm still in the despair phase of San Francisco summer, which is when it just is foggy and not very warm every day in August. When you feel summer ticking away and that you didn't get your fair share,
maybe
that's what happens right before we get the Indian summer, basically, where we get 6 weeks of the best weather of the whole year. So I will turn around. But right now I'm in the San Francisco seasonal affective disorder zone of being sad because it's not warm and it's still summertime.
I feel like maybe we should do an exchange for a couple weeks. Like, you can come here and enjoy the toasty warmth, and I can go there and enjoy the cool fog.
Interesting idea. Interesting idea.
I can
a
enjoy.
Little house swap.
Yeah.
I can get some of that steamy Boston.
You'll be ready to go back home is the answer.
All right, I'm sure.
And I will be ready to hang out with the fog.
The truth is that I could drive about, you know, an hour, and it would be 90 degrees, probably.
Oh, yeah. I can drive an hour, and it will be the same exact temperature.
Yeah. See, that's it. You're trapped like a rat. I can just drive up the coast or inland, and I can get to someplace warmer, but that's not the case for you. You're doomed. Sorry.
It's true.
You're a native. This is how it is for you. I always remember going to Macworld Expo Boston when I started in the 90s, when I started working at Macworld, or Mac User, even. And, that was I'd never experienced. Well, I guess once as a kid, we took a summer vacation to New England. But I had never as an adult experienced Northeastern summer. And it was it was legendary. And I knew what I was getting into. But it's just like, wow, it is incredibly hot and incredibly humid. Just unbelievable.
Everybody,
California people don't know what that's like. It's just
everybody
beyond
thinks
us.
Of us only as a place where it's cold and snows a lot. Turns out we get the worst of both worlds.
Yeah. Well, but you're when the leaves turn in the fall, it's wonderful.
Yeah, fall is nice. So for that 2 weeks.
Yep.
That's pretty great.
Yep. It is what it is. It's where you live. So you got to deal with it. Here, all I have to deal with is that it's ridiculously moderately temperatured the whole year round, which means it doesn't get too cold, but it also doesn't get too hot. And if you like it hot, too bad.
It's a tough life. I understand.
It's not so bad, but it does make me, as somebody who grew up where it was a little bit warmer, because I grew up about 100 miles inland, it's a little sad to not have, like, feel like I'm getting a real summer.
Well, but, we could all just move to San Diego, where it's just pretty nice all year round.
Yeah, well, San Diego, I mean, San Diego's climate is very similar to San Francisco's, and the difference is that it's so much further south that everything is like 10 degrees warmer. So instead of it being foggy and 60, you know, it's foggy and 70, 72, and then the fog burns off and it's 78 or something. It's beautiful.
I will always remember a stand-up comedian I think I saw when I was a teenager who said, you know, his aspiration was to be the weatherman in San Diego. Today is going to be nice. Like, that's pretty much all you have to do.
Yeah, that's pretty. I went to college there, right? That's pretty much it.
I drove past your alma mater while I was out there last year.
Oh yeah, up in La Jolla.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, it's not a bad place. Not a bad place to go. There was a zero day today.
Yeah.
Today is day zero.
Today is day zero, which is not quite the same as a zero day. But yeah, sure. Today was day zero. Well, yeah. So there was this interesting story over on was Motherboard, right? Talking about a security vulnerability that had been discovered when a human rights activist in the UAE got this like weird text message, and having been hacked before, he was suspicious and he turned it over to some experts, and they just determined that it was the work of some sort of basically like an Israeli security firm.
Yeah, this is the Israeli security firm, I think, that was rumored to be the one that the FBI was working with.
Oh, really?
To uncode. I think that might be it. Or maybe it's a different Israeli security firm, but that's what I thought. But yeah, with government clients who exploit, bugs in software in order to take over and spy on people.
Zero day is one of those great infosec terms where, you know, it sounds really cool and technical, but basically what it just means is like it's not been seen before, right?
Yeah, it's like, well, it means caught with your pants down.
Yeah, exactly. Right, like how many days do you have to prepare for this, or how many days is this known about? Zero.
Right, because usually the way this works, and this is actually related to Apple doing, you know, speaking at Black Hat, which happened a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. and starting a bug bounty program where they will pay researchers to come to them with security problems that they've found, which is something that's standard, but Apple is now finally on board with that as well. The idea there is they bring you a bug, and that starts the clock. That then the bug is known, and a lot of times this will happen as people know from my podcasts. Like Clockwise, we have Linode almost every week, right? Mm-hmm. As a sponsor, and Linode is really good about this. And that's where I see it a lot. Is I'll get a message from Linode that says we are doing a forced reboot of the server on this date. And it's not one of those you should reboot your server to do an upgrade. It's like, we're going to do a forced reboot on your server on this date. And why is that happening? That's because there's a software patch that they need to fix and reboot the system. And that's because they know that there's an exploit, but it's not been made public.
Right.
But the software patch is happening. And that's how the clocks tick, is that, you know, if it's a zero day, it's out in the wild and everybody knows about it. And that's on the first day that it's revealed, instead of it being, you know, we went to Apple. So in this case, it's not actually day zero, I guess, right?
Because Apple knew about a patch. I mean, it was a zero day when they used it.
Yeah, or you could say the people who are not using iOS 9.3.5 are vulnerable as of today. It's known that they're vulnerable, even though they've been vulnerable for who knows how long to this. It's scary. I mean, you said on the link on Six Colors, it's scary stuff.
Well, yeah, and so basically what this tool does is remotely jailbreaks your phone and then makes it vulnerable to malware that can basically collect everything, like everything on the phone. Which is really scary, right? I mean, we keep a lot of our information in the phone these days, in increasing amount. We take it with us everywhere we go. There's a lot of sensitive information on there, and that's why Apple's, you know, works really hard to ensure the security of that device, because they know how important it is and how much information there is on it. So, you know, they have to take this very seriously, and I think they've done a much better job in the last few years of expressing how seriously they take it, and then like working with the security community, such as the bounty program that you mentioned. Like they've really, I feel like, especially with iOS, you know, because from day one, security has been a watchword of iOS, right? Like Apple's message has been, this is much more secure than the competition. And part of that is their whole, like the walled garden approach that they get dinged for sometimes, is the idea like, look, we control what goes on the phone, or we can control what is allowed on the phone. And that makes it much more secure, because every app that you install has to come from the App Store, as opposed to a platform like Android, which is much more open, which is, yep. You know, if that's what you're looking for, that's great. But it's also potentially a lot more vulnerable to, you know, security attacks, because there's just way more openness there.
Well, I've been seeing, because I follow Christopher Segovian, who's the nephew, of course, of Sal, who does AppleScript and Automator at Apple, and he's a security expert. And there's been all this talk because of Hillary Clinton's email server and all of that. And there was a story today on Slate that was apparently like why it's actually not a bad idea to run your own email server. And he was like, no. Because this is the thing, is if you're running your own email server, it's using whatever standard software. It's like that is way more likely to be compromised than Gmail.
Oh yeah.
Now you may or may not. I mean, and if you don't trust Google, you could also use Office 365. But what the people I follow through retweets and things from the people I do follow, it seems like in the security community, everybody's like, use a Chromebook, use iOS, use Office 365 or Gmail, and that's what you need to use, because those are huge vendors supplying you with email and things like that. They're the ones who are at the cutting edge of security.
Well, they need to be, so, because if their system gets broken in, think of mine, people get compromised.
Exactly.
Right?
And Chromebooks, it's the same way. It's like there aren't very many hacks for that, because it's right now it's partially because it's obscure, and it's also because Google's got a security team looking at that stuff. iOS similarly is the most secure of the mobile operating systems because of Apple's approach versus Google's approach.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, as someone who briefly thought about, well, maybe I should run my own mail server. Yeah. I was very quickly like, all the disclaimers on the guides at Linode and stuff for like doing that are like, don't do this. I mean, if your job is I'm an expert IT administrator and I run mail servers, like, yeah, okay, maybe that's fine for you, but that's very, very few people.
Yeah, well, that and that's why it's bad advice, right? It's not necessarily that the person is wrong if you are somebody who is an expert and you can control it all yourself. But the fact is, by saying run your own email server, what you're really saying is, I could do that. I can click install and set it up. It's like, no, don't do that. If you don't know all the ins and outs of this, don't do it.
Right. I mean, I used to work in IT, and even there, the IT stuff I did, which was supporting sort of like smaller satellite programs, like none of that involved. We did not run our own email. When I used to work at the Harvard Law Library, the library did not run its own email server. The law school ran the email server. And a lot of the stuff in there is supported by the university as a whole, right? And that's another big institution.
Yeah.
So they're handling, you know, they have plenty of people who are, you know, they have an army of people who are on call and, you know how all the ins and outs of that work, right? But like even in the smaller like satellite ID departments, we were under the umbrella of a larger organization because that was not something that you wanted to detail to as like a two-person IT department.
Well, and you could argue that, you know, even Harvard, let's say, is not going to have the security chops that Google's going to have.
Well, sure. And a lot of schools started using like Google Apps mm-hmm. for their email servers, including my alma mater several other places. So, you know, like definitely, I mean, that was more common in the 90s and 2000s before things like Gmail really existed. But a lot of them have switched to these large vendors because it's just the support is just so much easier, right? They don't have to have people who know all the ins and outs. They can outsource that to Microsoft or Google.
I ran my own mail server for a while, but it was, it was like MailShare, or I guess it went through a bunch of different names, but it was a Mac app. So I am doubtful about whether it was, it may have been impervious to hacking because it was so rudimentary.
Yeah, sure. And obscure, but, probably.
Yeah. My issue there was just, it was swamping my, at the time, DSL connection with mail messages from spammers, because the spammers would try to connect, and if they would connect, they would send their spam, and like all of that data was coming and slowing down my line. And so I finally just decided this is dumb, and I switched to Gmail, and I've been happy with that. But security, it's scary because, you know, so much of what everybody does now relies on these devices that we've got, and as a result, crime and also government surveillance are increasingly about breaking the security of those devices. And I know we talked about this with the FBI thing, but it comes back to it again now, which is we have left a period, I think, where people can put complete trust in the institutions like of their technology, and have to really ask themselves questions about it in a way that they couldn't. And it's scary, right? Because the iOS, as much as the security experts say, is a rock solid operating system, this is a big exploit. And right, well, Apple, to its credit, rushed and fixed it as soon as they found out about it. But still, it's scary. This is the frontier of spying and of crime.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing to remember is, you know, this is code. It's code written by people, and people are fallible. No matter their best intentions, no matter how smart they are, you know, all it takes is, you know, if you've done any programming, all it takes is one misplaced parenthesis or quote or anything, and that is just gonna screw you up. And so no matter how good and how much attention they pay to it, there are always cracks, there are always vulnerabilities. It's a question of how fast you respond to that and fix it when you become aware of them.
Right. And it's a complex system too, where a bunch of complex stuff is interacting with one with each other, and sometimes that can have unexpected results, where you get the, you know, I think that's like where the buffer overruns come from, is right. It's like nobody is expecting that buffer to overflow, and so they're not worried about what the buffer is doing. They're worried about doing their own thing. But when you put those things together, it creates a chain of events that allows things to be broken and arbitrary code to execute.
Right. And keep in mind too that a lot of the people doing, you know, the actual coding, though they may be, you know, security may be a concern for them, it's not always their expertise, right?
Yeah.
Like they don't know security, they don't always know the ins and outs of all the security. So a lot of times, and I mean, I've met a lot of programmers and engineers in my day, and you have a lot of these conversations where it's like, well, what happens if you do X? And they're like, why would anyone ever do X? And it's like, well, because they're trying to break your system, right? Like, that's why, why would someone shove all, like, the entire text of Atlas Shrugged into this form on your website? Well, they want to see if it breaks.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is what people do. And so people you don't always approach it with that in mind, because you're looking at building a feature and a software that people are going to use, and your hope is they're going to use it well. Like you're designing for the user who's going to be using this thing responsibly, instead of for the person who's going to try to, like, you know, take a sledgehammer to it.
So can we talk about board games?
Oh yeah, hell yeah, we can talk about board games all day.
You just posted a link to this, and I thought it was, because you've talked to me about this before, I thought that this was fun, and you linked to a piece on Slate about the future of board games, and it's got a great line in it, which is the guy who created Pandemic Legacy saying, you know, they were talking about Clue, and he said, I don't know why I keep inviting these people over, they're all murderers. And this is the challenge of, you know, for some people, having the variations in the base game is comforting and it keeps it simple. But I know that there are also people who like the idea that a game is something that evolves over time. And that's what Pandemic Legacy is all about. And the risk, what is it? Risk
Legacy as well. Yeah.
Risk Legacy. All yep. right. Which
the
is the
legacy
which is the same
system
thing.
Is what sort of they dubbed it. Yeah. It gets at my this was my fundamental frustration as a kid with cartoons, is that you would watch these like Saturday morning cartoons and you'd watch one episode and then you watch the next episode. And pretty much invariably that next episode, like everything reset, right?
Yes.
Like
sure.
there's no continuity between
the reset
them.
Button. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he describes why do these games have to be like Groundhog Day with just things starting over and over again. And the answer is some games are, that's fine. Like there are a lot of games where it doesn't really matter like why you're doing these things over and over again, right? Yeah. It's a different sort of game. But I love this idea. It's somewhere between a board game and something like a role-playing game, right? Like D&D, if you're playing that has a certain lived-in continuity. But it's very freeform, whereas these are a little more regimented. And so we played Risk Legacy for a while, my friends and I, and I enjoyed that. My biggest frustration with it is, though I've never been a huge Risk fan, but I've definitely played it a few times, over the years, my biggest frustration with that also is just that it is highly competitive, and it's one of those games that, like, you know, people get into fights and they get angry and then they get, like, you know, swear vengeance on the other person. It just sometimes it can be a bit messy. What I like about Pandemic Legacy is that it's a cooperative game, and so it takes this framework. It's very, very similar gameplay wise to the game Pandemic, which is a cooperative game about you fighting the outbreak of all these different diseases, but instead it unfolds over the course of 12 months. I'm putting that in air quotes. Basically, like, you play a game in each month. You can play up to two games in a month if you lose that first game in the month. And it sort of shows this unfolding storyline as you go about these diseases striking, you know, the world at large. And you're like a small team of CDC researchers who are trying to like keep it under control. But things change as you go. Like, you know, you get different objectives in a different month. Stuff happen. I don't want to go into too much because I don't want to do spoilers. But like there are like sealed boxes that you open when you hit certain milestones. You know, and there are characters that you play, and characters can be lost and die, essentially. You know, there is stuff gets written on the board, stickers get put on the board, cards get ripped up. We have a friend who really doesn't like that. So we do it in front of his face a lot because we're jerks.
I love that idea. The one when you told me about Risk Legacy, that was the thing that really blew me away, is like putting stickers down on the board and like the board has just changed. For all future games, the board is not the same anymore.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
just wacky.
It's great.
That's so
it's,
wacky.
It's fascinating too. I mean, in Risk Legacy in particular, there was a moment where something irreversible happened that changed the entire course of the board, and we're all just like, "Oh my god, I can't believe that just happened." But that idea that then the next game it's still there, right? Like, you haven't reset to condition zero. You are dealing with the consequences of your choices, and so in Pandemic Legacy, especially, like, these things unfold, and in some ways we've been very lucky in our game with the way, like, just the luck of the draw, like, you know, the way certain things, the chips have fallen, like, we've ended up with a situation that is more containable than I think a lot of cases it would have been. But we've had our fair share of disasters, including a completely, like, one of these games where we were basically in position to win a game, and we're like, well, if we basically go all the way around to, like, that person's turn again, we can get this, like, ultra bonus, like for like getting rid of a disease totally. And we're like, yeah, we should do that. And not really calculating the amount of bad things that were going to happen in the interim of just one round. And by the time it got there, we're like, oh my God, we literally just, we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. We had it and then we died. So, I mean, it's a hard game. Don't get me wrong. Like, it is a challenging game, but it's fun because you get to work with your friends to try and figure out the best strategies and to deal with all those consequences. So it's a highly recommended game. People get, I know some people who don't love the idea of a game that you can only play like a limited number of times, but you know, when you math it out, I mean, the amount that you're paying for that experience, if you do in fact play the game, the, you know, full, I think this, you can play sometime between 12 and 24 times Pandemic Legacy, depending on how well you do. You'll probably play somewhere, you know, probably around 15 or 18 games. And you know, you divide that up by the amount of time you play and, you know, by hour or whatever and what you're paying. And it's really that not that much worse than paying for like the movies. So honestly, I think it's still cool. And it's games that I've tended to play a lot of games that have gone in and out of style anyways. So you buy a game and you play it five or six times with your friends and then you move on to the next thing. Like, right. I feel like I get more times out of this game than I do out of a lot of the other games that have arguably more replay value.
Right, because in this way, you're actually, the game continues to be intriguing because it keeps changing.
And you're committed, too, right? Like, you're like, oh, I want to know what happens, like, down the road. I want to see what happens. So, yeah, I think there's a strong argument for it. So, I'm a big fan. Highly recommend it to anybody who plays board games or is interested in something a little more complicated than Clue or Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, Sorry. Yeah,
sorry.
It's never... Clue, it's
Canada,
a good point.
It's, they, in Canada, it's Sorry, I believe.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's very popular in Canada. Well, what else? We got another couple of minutes. I don't know if you've got anything else that's going on out there that you wanted to talk about.
Well, I think not to monopolize too much of today's show, but we did hit episode 100 of the podcast I do with Messieurs Lex Friedman and John Moulton, occasionally Guy English. Which was pretty exciting, because we're getting close to the 2-year mark for that too.
Yeah, it's funny how a bunch of second anniversaries are coming up here.
Yeah, strange. I think we started the week after Upgrade. I want to say.
Yeah,
I think about.
Yeah,
then.
That sounds about right.
As you said on the show, we're kind of surprised it lasted more than 10 episodes. it's fun. I really enjoy doing the show with those guys, and I'm glad that we've managed to keep it going for so long. We're selling t-shirts as a part of that. So you can go to reboundcast.com/shirts. Take a look at a shirt if you're a follower of that show. I think you'll like it. We're no end in sight, although we may be losing our frequent special guest Guy English. He's got other things in the fire, so he may not be available to us much longer. But it was good to have him on for the episode 100 extravaganza. I think he said it made this whole hellish experience worth it at the end.
who are you going to get as you're going to need a new frequent replacement for Lex?
I know. I don't know yet. We'll take
Lex.
Lex
is a hard man to schedule, isn't he?
He is. He is. He's a busy man. He's an important busy man.
He's doing a lot of... Well, we'll see how important he is, but he's busy. I got him flying all around. Now, it was bad enough when he lived in New Jersey and he worked for a company in L.A., but now he lives in New Jersey and works for a company in L.A. whose owners are in Cincinnati, so now he seems to be traveling to all of those places.
I think he ends up in New York a fair amount too, which fortunately is a little closer. But
yeah,
he does a lot of traveling. So we'll have to take applications. Maybe we'll do like a Celebrity Apprentice thing.
Oh, nice. You could be on the Rebound.
Yeah, you could. We'll make you do tryouts. If you can't hack it, we'll let you know pretty fast too.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. I enjoyed being on the Rebound that time.
You've been on twice, I believe.
Oh, that's true. I was one on once just remotely, and once with the. When you were here.
Yes. Yeah. See, we invite you back for a second. You're the only only other person I think who's been on. Oh, wait, that may not be true. John Armstrong might have been on once. But you're certainly the only other repeat.
I'm right there behind Guy. It's like you and John, then Lex, then Guy, and then way down there is me.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But you're a step above John Armstrong too, so there you go. It's a close
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, in your face. John Armstrong.
I noticed you wrote a piece over at Macworld about Apple Music and about being trapped in a dungeon of Apple Music.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny. My point was, like, I used to have these arguments with Chris Breen all the time about music subscription services, because he would be like, it's so great for music discovery, and you can find anything, and then you can just listen to it, and it's super easy. And I said, yeah, but if I pay for it, I get to keep it. And if I have a music subscription service, then if there's music I like and I want to stop using a music subscription service, all that music goes away and I have to buy it or never listen to it again. And my piece on Macworld is basically like, yes, both of those are true. Like, I have completely embraced having a music subscription service. It's let me discover a lot of new music. I use Apple Music, but I think the same is true for Spotify or anything else. I've discovered a lot of new music. It's great. I really love it. And after a little more than a year of using Apple Music, I realized that my buyout for Apple Music, if I wanted to keep all the music that I've added to my library in the last year, it's like $300. And it's only going to keep increasing. So the longer I'm a member of a music subscription service, the more painful the breakup. If I want to keep any of the music. I mean, because if you look down 5 years, in 5 years, all the music that I will have discovered in the last 6 years will be music I don't own, and that vanishes and I can never listen to it. Now, a certain percentage of the music I'm not going to want to listen to anymore. But what's that percentage? And if it's $300 a year, okay, and half of it I care about, that's $900 in music that instead of paying for over the course of that time, I put into my monthly subscription fee. And it's just my point was basically to say that's this is a very I'm trapped in a very comfortable cell, but I'm trapped there, as is anyone else who uses a music subscription service. That's the brilliance of the service. Once you pay, you kind of can't ever not pay.
It's like
someone.
It's like you're sitting on your couch and it's really comfortable and it's like, oh man, I could use a drink of water, but it's really far away. I'm just gonna stay here. It's very comfortable. I'm kind of trapped on my couch.
It's not going to go well if you stay there forever, is what I'm saying. But it's, you know, this is and I think it's more true of music, because music is something you listen to over and over and over again. I some people likened it to, like, Chris Breen likened it to HBO. I've seen people liken it to Netflix. It's like, the difference is, like, there's other TV shows. I watch some stuff on HBO and then cancel HBO, and I'm fine. I would have to buy The Wire on Blu-ray or something if I wanted to watch that again, but that's not quite the same as, like, these albums that I listen to over and over again when I'm working.
The investment's
very different.
Now
gone.
Yeah, the investment's very different. That's part of the reason I've never really gotten into the streaming music thing, is because of that, and because I am not a broad consumer of music. I tend to listen to the same things over and over again. And so for me, that's not a great value trade-off. But I also wonder just about the eventual sort of evolution of this, right? Like, you know, 10 years ago, there were some streaming services, but people were pretty happily buying music from iTunes and Amazon and stuff like that. And it's, you know, the balance has started to shift towards streaming. Doesn't mean that that's the only ultimate form of music consumption, right? But it's definitely a model that has become much more prevalent. And, you know, that has some issues because of some of the ways, you know, as with all stuff in music, there are middlemen, there are, you know, lots of other labels and, you know, organizations that want to take their cut of it. And so it's a good deal for the consumer as long as you're in comfortable staying there. There's an open question of how good it is for the artists.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I assume we talked about this on Clockwise. I assume it's a terrible deal for the artists. That's what we've seen. Well, I had a back and forth with Dave Nanian, the developer, on Twitter today, where he was like, well, I also buy the music because, I want to support the artists. And it's like, you know what? I'm not convinced. Let's say, if I want to support the artists, buying the music again, separate from my streaming service, in a download or a CD form, so that they get 1% instead of 0.1%, I I'm not sure. I mean, maybe if that soothes your conscience, then
or
so be it.
If everybody were doing that, it might make a difference. But
I mean, artists are so exploited by the record companies anyway that if people don't remember, before artists were getting exploited by music subscriptions, they were getting exploited by download sales, and before that, they were getting exploited by CD sales, and before that, it was tape sales, and before that, it was record sales. Because artists are always exploited by record companies, it is a terrible racket, and artists have to make a living doing things like touring and selling t-shirts, and these days setting up digital subscription things where you get music for a year, and those are things I do. Those are things I pay for artists I like. But not
every artist is capable of doing all those things either, right? Like that's the other trick, right? Like there are independent artists who can make a living doing some of those things because they have control. But a lot of the ones who sign with the giant record labels, they don't really have the ability to do that.
Exactly. And my understanding is that, you know, anyway, so that's my feeling is that, yeah, I want to support artists that I really like, but I'm not going to subscribe to a music service and buy all the tracks that I like. I'm just not going to do that. And I'll tell you what, if I could buy all those tracks direct from the artist, maybe I would, but it's going to the record company. And so it's like, okay, so I'm going to give more money to the middlemen and a little bit more money to the person at the other end who actually created it. You know, the system, it's not incumbent on me to change that system. That system is broken. And I feel like the advantage that the internet brings to these artists is that there are other ways that they can make money to get around that same broken system. And I feel like that's just where it has to be right now. Now, you know, I'm not convinced that the economics of musical streaming services will survive. I feel a little bit like we're in an unstated teaser phase, and that at some point all of these streaming services are going to be like, yeah, it's going to be $25 a month now. And because right now I feel like everybody's eating it, especially the artists, but everybody's eating it a little bit in order to get everybody to be like me and be like, I can't live without it, and get a whole new generation of music listeners who cannot imagine not having Spotify. And then they say, yeah, it turns out these economics don't really work for us, so it'll be $30 a month. And you just have to just suck it. Or you have to take, you know, go $300, $400 and go buy music again.
I'm going to stick with my Columbia House tapes.
Okay, good. Good. You get 10 for a penny. It's a pretty good deal.
You know, it's funny when you put it that way, it does make it sound a lot more like drug dealing. Sorry, the price just went up to $30 a month. Well, you know, the subscription thing, I'm not a music subscription service customer, but I am a subscriber to many different video services, and I'm interested to see how that's going to shake out, because I feel like that's also something that is dealing with this whole, there are so many of them, and there's fragmentation, and there's deals that get made that shift, you know, content from one place to another. So for example, you know, the CW, which I watch a bunch of shows on, including Arrow, which I recap over at The Incomparable, is pulling their stuff from Hulu this season. And so I'm not really sure yet how I'm going to watch those shows, because the CW has not really, like, given me a competitive other way to do this. And the answer is, I might be best off just like watching it on like TV, which
TV,
is weird.
I know.
And but like there's a lot of I don't know. I really liked Hulu. I liked what they were doing. I understood the frustrations with the service, but I think, you know, I kind of knew the writing was on the wall for them at a certain point, because they weren't going to be able to be that clearinghouse for everything, because all these broadcast networks and media companies were going to decide, hey, why are we giving a cut to this person? We can just make our own streaming service. And that's kind of what's happening right now, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I don't want to end up in a situation where I'm necessarily paying like $5 or $10 a month for like six different networks.
Now, well, this is what I always told people when they're like, oh, cord cutting's going to happen. It's going to be great because everything's going to be on the internet and we're going to save so much money. I was like, I was with you until that point. But I've been saying all along, it's like, they're going to get their money, right? I mean, these things cost a lot of money to make.
Yep.
They're going to get their money from you. And if they don't get it one way, they will get it another way. They will find a way to get their money from you. And that's just, yeah, the people will pirate things and all of that. But in the end, they will either be able to find a way to get money from people, or those channels will, or artists or record labels or whatever will cease to exist. Those are the only options. You get the money or you die. And talking to Tim Goodman, because I do a podcast, we're all just about promoting our other podcast today, aren't we, Dan? I do a podcast with Tim Goodman on The Incomparable called TV Talk Machine. He's the TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. And, you know, he talks about these sessions they have at their press tour where some of these cable channels, he's like, there's no way this channel is going to make it. Like, nobody knows what they are.
Right.
Nobody's heard of their shows. And in the end, you know, and they've got four new scripted TV series. It's like, it's never going to work because it's in a bundle somewhere and the bundles are going to probably fall apart. And people are going to, you know, in the end, they're making a lot of stuff right now, but at some point, the money has to be there or all that stuff's going to go away. And that it's just inevitable. So that's the scary thing about all of this, is in the end, people got to get paid. That's it. I, this is a tangent, but since we're promoting other things, the Relay FM members, one of the pieces we did for them, we did a Clockwise Top 4. I did a thing with Mike and CGP Gray, and there's a Reddit thread, because CGP Grey has this whole Reddit subreddit community, and there's a guy in there who's basically saying, "I don't want to pay for this. I don't really," and it's worse than that. It's like, I don't even listen to Cortex, but I don't want to pay for this. But it sounds cool, so I want it. And it's just like, okay, well, and then there an argument ensued that was sort of like, digital things have no value, and you should just give them to me. And we heard that at Macworld back in the day when we did the digital version of the magazine, and people were like, well, you know, the only reason I pay for print is because it costs you things to print it and mail it, right? And it's like, no, right. No, we have to pay the people who make it. And that the money has to come from somewhere. And so, like, you know, you don't get some stuff you don't get without paying, because if nobody pays, the thing doesn't get made. And even with piracy, right? Like, if everybody pirated everything, there'd be nothing to pirate. Because if nobody can pay to make things, then the things don't get made.
Yep. Somebody's got to pay. We appreciate you paying.
And guess what? You know, unless there's somebody out there who's pirating the Secret Podcast, which could happen. It's sort of security through obscurity. If you're one of those people, hey, it's not that expensive. Why don't you become a Six Colors member? And to all of the rest of you who have halos over your heads because you are Six Colors subscribers already, thank you for doing that, and thank you for listening to the Secret Podcast once again. All right, Dan, I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds like a plan.
Bye.
Bye.